It is a real privilege to be with you. I didn't quite anticipate the introduction. The introductions usually far surpass the person, so be mindful that that's often the case. I am glad to be a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ and glad to be a part of His kingdom, and that is the best possible place for any of us to be. And we all have our individual places of service in His kingdom. And it's my pleasure to be with you tonight in the capacity as a leader for this particular conference. And again, I just thank the session and thank your pastors for this opportunity. I'm not real good at jokes, so you won't hear too many jokes from me. I do like to tell a story once in a while, and I will hopefully tonight be relating a little bit to you with regard to my past and my conversion as it has to do with the book of Daniel. So let's get started, and as I look at the clock, what's our deadline for this session? 8:15. You're going to subject these people to that length.
They're used to me.
They're used to you. Okay. Please turn to the book of Daniel, and let's read from the very first chapter of the book of Daniel. Hear God's word. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he... That's okay, go ahead. I'm going to let you go ahead and do what you need to do here. You can go ahead and make a spectacle of yourself. Okay. I precipitated this. So there we are. So now I better use this after this energy expended. That's great. Well, that's okay. All right, back in the first chapter of Daniel. Verse 3, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel, he assigned the name of Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food, the wine that they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them ten times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all of his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. May God be pleased to bless to us the reading of his word, and may he grant to us grace in a better understanding of his word. How many of you have heard of inductive Bible study? Any of you? Yeah, okay. Inductive Bible study begins by looking at the little pieces of Scripture and putting them together to get a bigger picture. We look at words and verses first, and then go to the bigger things. That's how inductive Bible study works. Deductive study begins with the big picture and works down to the little pieces. And we see that in biblical theology, and in seminary we study systematic theology. Now, one of the things that I try to impress upon my students is the fact that the inductive and the deductive always work together. The big picture and the little pieces must always fit together. And we always, whether we like it or not, we always come to the Bible with a view and with a picture ourselves, with a theology. And we're always attempting, by the grace of God, to bring our view of things into conformity with the Bible. And so we always have a big picture, and the little pieces are always fitting together in this big picture. And so we have to, I think, understand that this is the case. And part of my motivation, part of what I want to do in our studies is give you a big picture. We have to draw back and look at the big picture and then zoom in periodically and look at little pieces. So you will begin to see how the big picture in Daniel, and in the Bible for that matter, fits together, or the little pieces fit in with the big picture. And I liken this procedure to looking at the Bible as a big mosaic. And when you look at a mosaic, sometimes in an old one, there are pieces that are missing. There are blank places. And that's how it is with our view of the Bible. There are little blank places. And in other places in the mosaic, there are a few pieces, but we don't see how the pieces go together. And we have to live with some of that, because we're in the process, and this is what we're going to be doing in Daniel, we're in the process of putting little pieces together in a big mosaic to get a big picture of what Daniel is about here. And so as we look at this look at the book of Daniel and dip into Daniel, we're going to be filling in a larger mosaic. This is part of my desire. This is part of what I want us to do. And what we will see in the book of Daniel, as your pastor has already indicated, that the major theme is the theme of divine sovereignty. That God is in absolute control of all things. And this is a message, friends, that you need to understand and I need to understand better. And this is a message that the Israelites of old who were in captivity needed to understand. That God is the one who is in control. Sometimes when we look at Daniel, we think that part of the purpose of the book of Daniel is Daniel gives us these nice stories, and they are great examples. So you need to dare to be a Daniel, right? You need to be like Daniel and be courageous like Daniel. And we tend to moralize and use these stories in this fashion. Well, that's all right to an extent, I would submit to you. But what you have to realize and what I have to realize is that the main character in the book of Daniel and the main character in the Bible is God. This is all about what God is doing. This is all about what God is doing in dealing with His people. And this is all about how God is using a group of people to accomplish His will. And this is why it's an important lesson for you and me. Because out of this we can draw a deeper understanding of how the sovereign God uses people like us to accomplish His purposes in the world. And His purposes are firm. This is one of the things that we see. Hence the theme, God's sovereignty, your security. That's how these two things go together. So, I want you to understand this bigger framework and this idea of a little larger framework that I'm operating with as I come to you this evening. Now, if you open the little booklet that I gave you to page 1, and I noticed that some of you were looking at some of the diagrams, the Denny diagrams, and I apologize. You'll see these are done by hand. If I was better on the computer, I'd have all this stuff computerized, but that's not the case. So we'll be looking at some of those diagrams, and I'll be attempting to explain them to you. Now, let's get into the first chapter of Daniel, and let's read the first two verses once again, please. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Notice two things in these two verses. Number one, the king that verse 1 speaks of, Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim with an M, okay? Just get that. Just notice that that's the case. And then in verse 2, notice, what does it say? The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. That is, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Here's our first indication of who's running the show. And who is it? It's the great God of heaven. Correct? This is what's happening here. Okay? Now, please keep your finger in Daniel. And let's go back to 2 Kings. In your notes, I have 1 Kings. This is known as a typo. And these typos exist to keep people like me humble. And there'll be more than one of these. So, please go back to 2 Kings and chapter 24. And I want to read a little bit in chapter 24. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim, you see that name there now, this is the same king that we met already in Daniel 1:1. Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years, and then he turned and rebelled against him. The Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Arameans, bands of Moabites, and bands of Ammonites. So he sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through his servants the prophets. Surely at the command of the Lord it came upon Judah. See again, notice God's hand here. To remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done. Also for the innocent blood which he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not forgive. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiakim, see, different king, his son became king in his place. The king of Egypt did not come out of his land again, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Now, the reason I'm going back to 1 Kings is that this gives us the historical context for the book of Daniel. In 1 Kings 24, or 2 Kings 24 and verse 1, the year is 605 B.C. Nebuchadnezzar has just become, he is about to become the king of Babylon. And this is the first siege of Jerusalem. This is the first siege of three different sieges that Nebuchadnezzar brings against the city of Jerusalem. And this happens over a number of years. And it's important to get this because, especially when you read other books of the Bible, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, if you don't understand that there were three separate deportations into Babylon, it gets a little confusing as to what Jeremiah and Ezekiel are speaking about. And I'll attempt to give you a little bit more on that in just a moment. Verse 8 in 2 Kings 24. Jehoiakim, okay, this is the next king, was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city became under siege. This is the second time that Jerusalem comes under siege. Now, what happens is that in 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar breaks off his siege of Jerusalem because his father, Nabopolassar, dies. And Nebuchadnezzar has to go back to Babylon to take control of the kingdom. And now he comes back a second time to lay siege to Jerusalem. See, this is a long process. And it's a long, bitter process as far as the Jews are concerned and as far as Jerusalem is concerned. Verse 10. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his captains and his officials, So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. Okay. He carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, the king of Israel, made in the temple and of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest of the land. So he led Jehoiakim away into exile into Babylon. Also the king's mother and the king's wives and the officials and the leading men of the land he led away into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. All the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the smiths, 1,000, all strong and fit for war. And these the king of Babylon brought into exile to Babylon. Okay? Now, keep in mind, this is the second siege. Now, if you still have your finger in Daniel, you still have your finger there? Okay. Right before Daniel is the book of Ezekiel. This is sword drill. And go to the very beginning of Ezekiel. So I usually say this to people, and then they're like this. Okay, I've got six fingers in the Bible here. All right, at the beginning of Ezekiel. Now it came about in the 30th year of the 5th day of the 4th month, while I was by the river Kabar among the exiles, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel, the priest, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kabar, and there the hand of the Lord came upon him. Okay? Now, why does Ezekiel mention Jehoiakim with an N rather than Jehoiakim with an M? It's because Ezekiel was taken into captivity during this second siege of Jerusalem. That's why. And he mentions 30 years here because he's 30 years old. And so we can figure the date of his birth, basically. This is part of what happens in the Bible. Okay. Now, this is interesting to people like me because when you read Ezekiel, you realize he's in captivity, but he's still talking about Jerusalem that is going to be destroyed. And the reason that this is the case is that there were three different times that Nebuchadnezzar went up to Jerusalem to lay siege to it. In 605, Daniel is taken into captivity. In 597, Ezekiel is taken into captivity. And then there's a third siege of Jerusalem in 586, in which Jerusalem is destroyed. Okay? And when you realize that this is the case, these books make a little more sense. And part of what happens is that Jeremiah is left back in Jerusalem. Daniel has already been in captivity for years. Ezekiel is taken into captivity next. Jeremiah is over here prophesying in Jerusalem saying the city will fall. Ezekiel is over in captivity in Babylon saying, that's right, it's going to happen. And then Daniel is in a third location in Babylon proper. God has got his hand in different places doing different things in order to confirm his purposes. This is part of what we see. And here in a moment I want to look at a map to draw this out a little bit. Okay, 2 Kings 24 again. Zedekiah was 24, verse 17. Then the king of Babylon made his uncle Mattaniah king in his place and changed his name to Zedekiah. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that Jehoiakim had done, that is, his ancestor, for through the anger of the Lord, this came about in Jerusalem and Judah until he cast them out from his presence. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Now in the ninth year of his reign, and on the tenth day of the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and his army, against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. Now, again, this is the third siege of Jerusalem. While this is taking place, Daniel is back in Babylon. And Ezekiel is back in Babylon, or in the area of Babylon. Okay, now, look at the very end. Go back, please, to Daniel chapter 1. And look at the very end of Daniel chapter 1. Verse 21. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. Say, boom! We've traversed the entire length now of Daniel's captivity in the first chapter until Cyrus comes and the decree is given for the release of the Jews. I'm just pointing that out to you. And on page one in my outline, I've got these dates and the idea of the deportations. Deportation 1, 605, Deportation 2, 597, Deportation 3, 586, Cyrus's Decree 538. Very possible that there was no departure until after that, a year later. And so if you take that entire period of time, including the year 605, and the year 537, that's 70 years. That's the 70-year captivity. And there's usually some questions about how this captivity is designated. Well, that's the 70 years. From the first deportation, including that, until after the decree of Cyrus. Okay, now, on page 2-1, I've given you a map, and this is a little more modern map, but I thought this might be helpful. Iran is Persia. Iraq is Babylon. And south of Baghdad, you see Baghdad there on the upper Tigris River. You'll see south of Baghdad, the place where Babylon existed. Okay? That's where Daniel was. Now, Ezekiel was probably in an area that was further south on the Euphrates River, and there was an enormous canal system that had been developed. And this is why you hear the Kibar River in Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is probably further south in an area along several canals south of the Babylon area. And then if you go east a little bit, I know for some of you the print's a little small. It's a little small for me, too. You'll see Susa, the location of Susa. This should ring a bell. This is where Esther was later located, with King Ahasuerus, the Persian king. Okay. And then on the next page, you'll see a map where we have Jerusalem in Israel. And On the upper Tigris River, you'll see where Nineveh, the city of Nineveh, is located. This is a very prominent area, isn't it? Nineveh was the capital of Assyria. And this is the place where Jonah was privileged to preach and see a great revival. This occurred much earlier. But at any rate, just to give you an idea that there was a dispersion of Jewish people across the Middle East. And this is part of the genius of what God was doing. He was dispersing His people in a wide area like salt in the earth in order that later the gospel of Jesus Christ could be effectively preached through the synagogues that were developed by these people who were dispersed over a wide area. God had His purposes. And I want to tell you something right here, that as a result of these very purposes and the preaching of the gospel, people like you and me are able to sit here tonight. This has a direct effect and a direct impact on each one of us. On page 3, I won't spend a lot of time here. I've given you a general chronology. Poor Ray has seen this. It starts early, and you'll see the fall of Samaria listed there. That's the northern kingdom. And Samaria was overrun by the Assyrians. You'll see Isaiah listed. Here's a little clue on dating. Isaiah, the year in which King Uzziah died, Isaiah was called 740 B.C. About 100 years later, Jeremiah was born. And that's a little way to help us understand the time of Jeremiah. You'll see down a little bit further, 605, Nebuchadnezzar's first siege of Jerusalem, Daniel taken captive, 593, Ezekiel's call in Babylon, and 597, Nebuchadnezzar's second siege of Jerusalem, and 586, Nebuchadnezzar's third siege of Jerusalem, and then further down, Cyrus's decree. Just trying to get you to see the time frames that the book of Daniel is dealing with. And then I, in the next page, I gave you a fold-out timeline. And later you may want to take a look at this. On the right-hand side, above the timeline, you'll see Assyrian power, Babylonian power, Persian power. These are the three major eras late in the Old Testament, the time when Assyria was in power and they conquered the northern kingdom, the time when the Babylonians were in power and they conquered the southern kingdom, the time when the Persians were in power and Cyrus releases the Jews from captivity, along with others, I might add. And you can see that the time of Daniel that I've given there on the timeline. Okay, just again, to give you an idea of where we are as far as time and chronology are concerned. Now, back to Daniel 1. When we begin to look at Daniel and the book of Daniel in chapter 1, and this is true of other chapters, Daniel 1, like other chapters and other narratives in the Bible, is very typical as far as a narrative is concerned, a story, if you will. There's a setting, okay? And we get that in the first couple of verses where Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Jerusalem and brings these folks into captivity. Then we have characters that emerge, Daniel and his three friends. And then we have a plot, don't we, in the first chapter. And the plot begins to arise when we find that the king wants to train all of those young men, including Daniel and his three friends, he wants them to go to school in Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar has certain ideas about sending them to school. Indoctrination. That's one of Nebuchadnezzar's ideas. And then Daniel says, hold it. I don't think I'm ready to go in that direction. And the plot thickens, doesn't it? Now what's going to happen? Daniel, it appears, with his three friends, are in a compromised position. But we discover that God gives Daniel and his friends favor in the sight of the overseers. Who's in control? God is. And because God gives Daniel and his friends a place before the overseers, the plot begins to be resolved. And when the king examines Daniel and his three friends, he finds that they far excel others in wisdom and understanding and grace. And you can see how the plot rises, comes to a turning point, and there's resolution. Don't you like stories that come out well? It's very interesting how on TV these days, when the story leaves you hanging, you say, oh, it ends there. There's no resolution. There's no ending that comes together satisfactorily. There's no, and they live happily ever after. And we're looking for that resolution. And we, I think, need that kind of resolution. And in the Bible, we find that kind of resolution that takes place because God is in control of all things. If you'd look at page 5 now in my booklet, I've given you what I call a literary analysis of the first chapter of Daniel. And we're going to see, those of you who are willing to hang with me at least, we're going to see a little bit more of this. Don't be afraid of speaking about the Bible as literature. When I speak about the Bible as literature, I'm not saying these are just little stories that are mythical and hanging out there. That's not what I mean. The Bible is literature. It is literature because it is that which has been written in a particular style by authors who have been inspired by God. And as we look at the book of Daniel, a particular style is going to emerge. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that next hour. But in this style, and I've got it laid out in a pattern here for you on page 5, in this pattern, it happens in chapter 1, the middle of the story, which is the turning point, is that which is key. And that comes to us, you'll see it, I have in the little box there, the turning point, in verses 11 through 13. But Daniel said to the overseers, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. When Daniel stands up and says, "Put us to the test," everything changes. Everything changes in chapter 1. And there's a shift now toward a resolution of the conflict that had been building. And under God, Daniel says, "Put us to the test." Where is Daniel's faith? In the living God. And what does Daniel expect the outcome to be? Positive. Because he knows he serves the living God. And he knows that all of this is part of God's plan and God's purpose for him and his three friends. Now, you'll notice something else in this chapter. I've already mentioned it in the beginning of the chapter. The Lord gave Jehoiakim. And then in verse 9, "Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion." And in verse 17, "God gave them knowledge and intelligence." God's the central character here, and God's the one who is guiding and directing and leading Daniel and his three friends. Now, part of what happens in chapter 1 is that we have an introduction for the rest of the book. And we have the scene set now for the rest of the book of Daniel. Daniel is put in a place of authority along with his three friends in the government of Nebuchadnezzar. Now think about this for a moment. Daniel and his three friends rise to places of eminence and power in the government. In a pagan government. In an idolatrous government. Is it a good thing for Christian people to be in high places? Absolutely. It's important for Christian people to be in high places. It's important for Christian people to be in other places too. Our oldest daughter is an assistant principal in a high school. And a public high school. And an assistant principal does a lot of disciplinary work. And so Gail has a lot of interaction with young men and women. And she also has a lot of influence with peers and teachers because of her position as an administrator. And I say to her, and I say to people who are in like positions, you are the glue that holds the system together. It is vital for Christians to be in such circumstances. We would be in chaos and in desperate straits were it not for God placing Christian people in important positions. And I'm thankful that although the President of the United States of America may not have all of the intimate details of biblical theology straight, he names the name of Christ. And that has an effect on our nation. And you have an effect on our nation also in a very different way by being people who love Jesus Christ and who work in the world in sometimes pagan situations, but you are salt and light. And this is part of how God operates. And in His sovereignty, He has placed you in various positions and in various capacities for this very purpose. What a wonderful thing it is. I like to go to Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purposes. Was Daniel called by God? Yes. Did he love the Lord his God with all of his heart? Yes. You know what Romans 8:28 says about Daniel's circumstance? That everything in the kingdom of Babylon was being ordered for the good of Daniel and his three friends. I want you to think about that for a moment. That everything was being ordered by God for the good of Daniel and his three friends. God's sovereignty was His security. And if that was the case for Daniel, I submit to you, dear friends in Christ, that God is ordering everything in your world, in the United States of America, in our world, I dare to say, in the universe, God is ordering everything in the universe for your good and for the good of His people. That every molecule that exists in this universe is being ordered by the hand of Almighty God for your good. I think we just need to sit back and soak that up a little bit. That there is nothing that is taking place that is out of the hands of God and is not being ordered by Him for the good. Isn't that what Romans 8:28 says? For the good of His people. Now, do we always understand how the intricacies of God's providence are being worked out for our good? No. And in the book of Daniel, we're going to see some difficult things that Daniel goes through. But I want to leave you there with chapter 1 with that idea that all that was going on in the life of Daniel and all that is going on in your lives is ordered by God for your good. And Daniel, loving God, trusted Him implicitly. And when he said to the overseers, "Test us. Go ahead, test us." His thought was, "Oh God, You're going to work this for good for me and my friends. And that's exactly what we see. And that's how the stage is set, it seems to me, in the book of Daniel.